Discussion on whether Hong Kong's legal system is any better than the mainland's. Her colleague, Kevin Egan, who is on the board here at the club and head of chamber at Baskerville Chambers, also here to comment. We will hear from each person separately, and then we will leave time for discussion and questions at the end. Guessing by the number of legal people in the room, it should be quite interesting. So let me start by inviting Jema to come and speak.
Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. Today, my colleague, Mr. Egan, and I are going to share with you some of the observations of the differences between the legal system in China and the legal system in Hong Kong. Why am I sharing this topic? It's because this time last year, I spent 4 months in Beijing learning their law and taking their national judicial exam. And that's why today I'll be talking mainly on the features of the legal system in China, whereas Mr. Egan will tell you how the equivalent parts operate in Hong Kong. Now, as you may know, the legal system in China is a statutory system as opposed to our common law system. So case precedents are not binding on them. So they rely on the statutes and interpretations of statutes. Now in China, for nationwide applications, the interpretations can come from three main institutes. The first one in Mandarin, 全国人大常委会, that's the National People's Congress Standing Committee. And the second one is 全国最高人民法院, that's the highest people's court in PRC. And the third one is 最高检察院, that's the prosecution division of the highest level in PRC. But of course, China is not the only place that practices this statutory system. Places like Japan, Taiwan, and Germany practice the same. And just to give you an example to see how the two systems differ in terms of their substantive law. About 6 months ago, two Hong Kong girls went to Taiwan, falsely claiming that they were university students asking for a flat, and this poor landlord believed them and rented them the flat. But these two girls, apart from not paying the rent, and apart from turning the flat upside down, they took away some furniture and home appliances from the flat. And all these were captured by the CCTV installed in the building. And that's why they were eventually arrested and prosecuted in Taiwan. Now, I read from the newspaper, the prosecution in Taiwan charged them with this offense, 侵占罪. Now, the nearest English I can think of is appropriation. Appropriation is an element of our offense of theft. Now, I would have thought if the same situation occurs in Hong Kong, they would be charged with the offense of theft because we don't have the offense of appropriation. But in China, they also have this offense of appropriation. But if you are charged with appropriation in China, the penalty you are going to face would differ greatly from when you are being charged with the offense of theft. And why is it? Because in China, there are three institutes that can initiate court proceedings. Now, they're obviously different from us. The three institutes are, first of all, 检察院, the prosecution division. The second one, 公安机关, the public security bureau. And the last one is 法院, the court itself. They can initiate court proceedings. And for this particular offense of appropriation, the victim of this offense will have to lodge his or her complaint directly with the court. So no point complaining about this to the PSB, they won't help you. No point complaining this to prosecution, they won't help you. What they will do is they will tell you, you go to court directly and lodge your complaint. And the court, if the court thinks this case amounts to appropriation, then they will open a file for you, they will open all the court proceedings for you. But then for these court proceedings, when the court initiates the court proceedings, the offences are usually considered to be less serious, and a maximum penalty would be no more than 3 years imprisonment. However much value of property is involved for this appropriation offence, for example, you might have appropriated property over $1 million, still you will be charged with this appropriation offence and you will face a penalty of no more than 3 years. But if you're charged with theft with property over $1 million in China, your penalty may go up to life imprisonment. That's the maximum. So you see the difference, and we don't have that. We don't have that appropriation offence. And that was the case 6 months ago. A more recent example was last week. Last week, Jackie Chan's son and a Taiwanese singer were arrested in Beijing for dangerous drugs-related offences. Now, this is a good case to show you how we differ, both in terms of the substantive law and the procedural law. For the Taiwanese singer, he was given 14 days remand. And what does that mean? In Mandarin, is 行政拘留, is the administrative remand. And what is an administrative remand? It is a kind of administrative punishment in China. There are 7 types of administrative punishment. They include a warning, a fine, confiscation of illegal proceeds, cancellation of your license, suspension of your production, administrative remand, and if you're a foreigner, the last one, they can kick you out. But then what is the remedy for that? If you are subject of one of these punishments, what can you do? What if you are not happy with the punishment? What if this Taiwanese singer thinks, well, they shouldn't have locked me up? What can he do? Now, the remedy for that is he can then take them to court. He can take the PSB to court. And in that case, he will be the plaintiff and the PSB will be the respondent. And then he can complain to the court that he shouldn't have been given 14 days remand. That is not fair. And then he can ask for compensation. Now, the good side of having the administrative punishment instead of being taken to court is that when this guy finished his sentence or punishment, he won't have a criminal record. If the newspaper reports are correct, that he was found to have in possession dangerous drugs. If the same situation happens in Hong Kong, he will no doubt be charged with possession of dangerous drugs. But that case in China, in Mandarin, they say 不构成犯罪. It means exactly that. They think it didn't amount to a criminal offence. And that's why they didn't charge him, they didn't prosecute him, they didn't take him to court. Basically and effectively, it means he was given a chance. And that's why after his release, if he is a legitimate citizen in China, he can still apply to be a civil servant, he can still apply to be a lawyer. It won't be affected at all. But for J.C. Fong's case, again, if the news reports are correct, his case is different. His case is a good case to show you how we differ in both terms. He is likely to face an offence called 容留他人吸毒. In English, it means allowing somebody to take dangerous drugs by providing an accommodation. Now, we don't have this offence in Hong Kong. Okay, but for this offence in China, it amounts to a criminal offence. And that's why he's now under investigation. And the procedure in China, again, is different from us. They will remind you first, but it doesn't mean that you are arrested. They remind you first, the PSB will do the investigation. And at the same time, they will pass the file to the prosecution, to the 检察院, and ask them to approve for his arrest. And once the prosecution approves his arrest, he will then be formally arrested. So far, I've heard nothing, so maybe they still haven't decided on that. But once they decide to prosecute him to approve his arrest, he will then be prosecuted and he will be taken to court, going through all the court proceedings. And after that, if he gets convicted, he will have a criminal record. That's the main difference between us. But for today, I would like to focus mainly on the procedural differences between the system in China and the system in Hong Kong. Now, depending on the time, I would like to cover five areas. The first three are related to appeals. Now, number one, what happens if there's no appeals lodged either by the prosecution or the defense? What happens to those judgments which are already in force? For example, I get convicted and I'm sentenced to 3 years imprisonment, and I didn't lodge my appeal, prosecution didn't lodge their appeal, and I'm now serving the sentence, so the judgment is now in force. Now, what if there are errors in my judgment? What is the remedy? Now, in China, they got this procedure called 审判监督程序. That is like a review or supervision procedure. And what does that mean? It means all the principal judges of each courthouse at each level will have to review his own cases. Like me, now I'm serving a sentence, but no appeals. They will have to review those cases. And if they find that there are errors in the judgment, in China, they don't have the power to order a retrial immediately. What the principal judges will do is they will refer the case to a committee called 审判委员会, the judicial committee. Again, we don't have that. And the judicial committee will then study the case, and they can decide whether they will rehear the case, and after the rehearing, then they will decide whether they will send it back for retrial. And that's their procedure. And I still remember after this lecture, I was having lunch with my classmates in Beijing. And by the way, I was the only student from Hong Kong. And I said to my classmate, I said, this procedure is good. And then they said to me, what do you mean by good? Don't you have the same in Hong Kong? I said, no, we don't have that. And then they asked me, then what if there are errors in the judgment? It's not fair. Then what to do? What is the remedy? I said, well, as what the lecturer said just now, without this procedure, right is of course right, but wrong is also right. Hard luck. And that's the first point. And then the second point is about the right to appeal. In China, and of course in Hong Kong, if you are not happy with the conviction or the sentence, you can always appeal. And by the way, there are only two levels of court in China, unlike us. We are three levels, court of first instance, court of appeal, and court of final appeal. But in China, there are only two levels, court of first instance and then court of appeal, which is also the court of final appeal. But they don't call it court of final appeal. They call them upper courts, lower courts. Now, if you get convicted in the lower court, of course you can appeal to the higher court. And what does that right to appeal mean in China? The upper courts strictly adhere to this well-known principle in China. And the first time I heard of this when I learned this course, it's called 上诉不咋行. Now, what does it mean? It means the upper courts cannot and must not impose a heavier sentence than the one imposed by the lower court. And the lecturer explained why this principle is important. And the rationale behind this principle is twofold. The first one, in terms of logic, they say, if you think the sentence is too lenient, if you think this guy shouldn't have been sentenced to 2 years, he should have got four, then the prosecution, the 检察院, has the duty to lodge the appeal. But if the prosecution didn't lodge the appeal, it means the prosecution also thinks the sentence is appropriate. And they say in that case, the upper courts should not and must not interfere with the sentence. And that's the first reason. And the second reason, I'm impressed by that. And they said the second reason is about justice. You imagine if you tell the defendant, the upper courts may increase or can increase your sentence if you appeal, then what sort of pressure will you give to the defendant? he may then abandon his appeal because he doesn't want to take the risk of having his sentence increased. And then they say this is not fair. And so they strictly adhere to this principle. And after I heard this principle, I was talking to my classmate next to me. She's from Inner Mongolia. I said to her, is this principle genuinely followed by the upper courts? And she said, of course, it's our well-known principle. It's not only applicable to court decisions, it's also applicable to judicial punishment. As I told you just now about the seven types of administrative punishment, if you take the department to court, if you're not happy with the fine of 5,000, you take them to court and sue them, the court cannot increase your fine. And then that's what she said to me, and I was hoping that she wouldn't ask me how the equivalent part operates in Hong Kong, and glad that she didn't ask me, because I felt a bit embarrassed at that point about how this right to appeal operates in Hong Kong. And you will soon find out from my colleague, Mr. Egan, that this is the second point relating to appeals in criminal cases. And then the third feature also related to appeals is the question of compensation. Now, what if you get acquitted by the upper courts? Is there any compensation? Now, in China, there is a law called Guozhapeichangfa. That's the national compensation law, which covers both your compensation from judicial decisions and administrative punishment. Say if you've been wrongly locked up by the PSB for 14 days and eventually the court finds that it's wrong, then they will quash that punishment and then you can ask for compensation. And there is a formula in monetary terms as to how they calculate your loss, that this is the average salary of workers of the previous year. And they will calculate the number of days you spend in jail, and they will give you the equivalent amount as a compensation. And just to give you an idea as to how much a person can get for this, in 1999 in Henan province, this poor guy got convicted of murder and sentenced to death, suspended for 2 years. And of course, after 2 years of good behavior, his death sentence was converted into life imprisonment. And then in 2010, this inverted commas, this dead person came back to life, went back to the village, and he said he wasn't murdered, he wasn't killed, he simply left the village 11 years ago. But coincidentally, he had a heated argument prior to his departure with this defendant. And so the whole village knew about it. But the next day, this guy disappeared. And anyway, the upper court immediately quashed the conviction and then released this guy from jail, apologized to him, and then pay him the compensation. And how much did he get for 11 years? He got 650,000 renminbi. Now, I think it's about 800,000 Hong Kong for 11 years. And when I heard this example, I was whispering to my classmate, I said, 650 for 11 years, not enough. And then she said, oh, how much will he get in Hong Kong? And then I said, oh, sorry, in Hong Kong, not even a cent. And she thought I was joking, but I wasn't joking. And that's the third point relating to appeals. And two more areas which you may find interesting. Now, the first one is their jury system. You may be surprised to know that there is also a jury system in China. But their jury system is different from us. Their jurors are unlike us, except the selection process is the same as us, randomly chosen from the eligible population, plus the fact that they need to be university graduates. But their role is different from our jurors because their role is exactly the same as judges. Because in China, for their trial, is usually a court composed of 3 judges, 5 judges, or 7 judges. And one of those can be a juror. But then the juror performs exactly the same duties as judges. The juror will decide not just on facts. The juror will also decide on the legal issues. Now, I'm not quite sure about the rationale behind this jury system, but I suspect it has something to do with the background of those judges in China. Because in the olden days, these judges were not legally trained. They're not legally qualified. They were simply civil servants or even military officers. And so they might think, well, jurors can do the same work. But now, of course, they changed. Now, in China, prosecutors, judges, and lawyers will all have to go through this national judicial exam. So they're all legally trained. But the jury system remains the same. And the last point is about bringing a civil claim together with a criminal charge. That again, this won't, but at the moment still, it's not happening in Hong Kong. Now in China, if this guy is charged with wounding, they don't have the offense of wounding. They say 故意伤害, is different from our wounding charge, but similar. So the victim got assaulted by this guy and wounded, and say he got a broken leg, then what can he do? Now he can, at the same time, while this guy is going through the trial for the criminal charge, he can at the same time bring his civil claim. And so the same panel of judges will decide both issues in one go, both the criminal charge and the civil claim, all in one go. And I think that's efficient. And so that's all I'd like to share with you. And you may want to know how the equivalent parts operate in Hong Kong now. And I pass to Mr. Egan. Thank you.
Oh, the eagerness and industry of youth. For the record, I'd like you to know that although I'm the head of Baskerville Chambers, of which Miss Maher is a member, we are universally known in the profession as Basket Case Chambers. And second point of reference is that when I'm referring to the People's Republic of China, I would prefer to refer to them as the glorious motherland. Don't think I'm being cynical. I find it rather ironic that I'm standing here today defending truth, justice, and the Hong Kong way of life, because in the last 25 years, no one has been more combative against truth, justice, and the Hong Kong way of life than perhaps me and my learned friend, Mr. Andrew Lam, sitting in the front row down there. So I find it rather ironic that I'm here today defending a system that I've spent 25 years fighting. But then again, that probably just reflects what most people think, which is that barristers really are sluts, paid mercenaries, driven by two principles. The first, have wig, will travel. The second, as you confide with your client, this is going to cost you. Now, those cynical remarks in respect of barristers have been around for a long time, because the 17th, 18th century Irish, although some would argue English, essayist Jonathan Swift of Gulliver's Travel fame once described barristers as a society of men brought up from their youth in the art of proving by words multiplied for the purpose that black is white and white is black according as they are paid. Right on, Johnny. Dealing with the difference between the PRC legal system and our legal system, I have to confess a certain degree of ignorance of the PRC system, but I rely on what my colleague Ms. Maher has told you. And if I could just address initially the five topics that she's addressed, and then I'll make some other observations about what I think are the virtues of our system. Their system is statutory, which means, as she's rightly said, there is no such thing as a common law of precedent and authority that binds either authoritatively or persuasively the courts in China. We have such a system. The common law is really no more than the common sense of the community crystallized and formulated by our forefathers. These days, the common law is significantly supplemented by statutory amendment. So we have a combination of statutory law and common law. We follow very much the English system, or the Commonwealth system, effectively. The first point she raised is quite an interesting one, where she says that there's a dual system for dealing with offences in China. One, an administrative system which does not result in a criminal conviction, and which effectively gives you a second chance if you're silly enough to make a mistake first time. And the second one, of course, is the traditional criminal system which we have here. We don't have that refinement down here, so to that extent, the mainland would seem to be ahead of us. We have something roughly similar here, but it's a discretion that's vested in the Director of Public Prosecutions. So what happens here is, instead of it being an institutionalized system, as it appears to be in the glorious motherland, down here, if you have a client who's charged with something that is borderline criminal, in your view, you write to the Director of Public Prosecutions. He won't answer you, of course. He'll pass it on to one of his underlings, and in due course, you'll get an answer back. But you can attempt to negotiate and persuade him that your client ought not to be dealt with at all criminally, or dealt with in a less severe way by way of a lesser offence, or by way of a system we have here called ONE Bindover, where a defendant who has a clear record and where the offence is not particularly serious puts his hand up and admits the facts upon which the charge was based, and then the prosecution offer no evidence against him and he's found not guilty, but he has admitted that he did what is alleged against him. And the whole idea of that is so that persons don't have criminal convictions where the offence in question is borderline criminal or not particularly serious. So it's a similar system, but it's not institutionalised. And it very much depends upon the discretion of the person who you ultimately deal with in the Department of Justice. And that's half the problem, because no two cases are ever dealt with the same way. The second point she made about appeals is interesting, because she says there's a separate system of appeal up there where even if neither of the parties to the litigation, the prosecution or the defence, if neither of them institute an appeal, the system itself may generate an appeal if upon review of the particular case, the reviewing panel comes to the view that something has gone amiss and there ought to be either a rectification of that or a retrial even. We don't have that here. The reason for that is probably because our system is adversarial, and I think our system relies upon the fact that because you've got barristers and solicitors involved on both sides, if there is the hint of an argument on appeal, we'll take it. So I think they assume that the interests of the defendant will be safeguarded by the industry of counsel. But the second point she made is very interesting, and it seems that their system is superior to ours in this regard. She says that up there, if you institute an appeal, or if an appeal is instituted by the reviewing authority itself, under no circumstances will the penalty that you suffer be increased if the appeal fails. Now, that's one of the disadvantages of our system. Again, their system appears in that regard to be better than ours, because in our system, there are two provisions of the Criminal Procedure Ordinance which are daunting from a defendant's point of view if he's been convicted. The first is that if he appeals and the Court of Appeal take the view that his appeal is without merit, they have the power to award loss of time served. So if he's already done 12 months waiting for his appeal to come on for hearing, and the Court of Appeal takes the view that the appeal was entirely without merit, they can order that he loses 3 months, 6 months of the time he's already served. So he's got to re-serve that over again. And trust me, 3 months or 6 months to a layman sitting here enjoying lunch mightn't sound like it's much. But when you're inside doing it, a minute's like an hour's like a day's like a week's like a month. So you lose 3 months, you lose 6 months, and you're virtually suicidal. The second provision is if you appeal against sentence, the statute makes it quite clear that the judges who review the sentence can either decrease the sentence, or if they think it wasn't serious or severe enough, they can increase the sentence. So in both cases, you have the sword of Damocles hanging over you if you are emboldened to appeal. And in many cases that I've dealt with personally, I know of people who have not been prepared to take the risk, even though I've tried to persuade them that the error was manifest, the sentence was either wrong or the conviction was wrong. They're not prepared to take the risk that they'll lose time or that their sentence will be increased. So again, that's a failure in our system which does not appear to exist in the mainland system. Criminal compensation. I deliberately brought along for you an extract from our Bill of Rights. It's Article 11, Subarticle 5, which reads, and I'll read it slowly. It reads, when a person has, by a final decision, been convicted of a criminal offence, and when subsequently his conviction has been reversed, or he has been pardoned on the ground that a new or newly discovered fact shows conclusively that there has been a miscarriage of justice, the person who has suffered punishment as a result of such conviction shall be compensated. Whoopee. Everybody who's convicted and has had their appeals overturned can write off to the government and say, dear Mr. CY Leung, please give me a couple of million. I've rotted in jail for 5 years. Wrong. That's what it reads to a layman and to a lawyer. But the way this has been interpreted by the courts, not only here, but elsewhere, and even in the human court, the European Court of Human Rights, is that you've effectively got to prove that you were innocent and should never have been charged in the first place. Now, proving a negative, you know, proving that I'm not guilty, is a very difficult thing to do. So consequently, very few cases succeed, which means as a result that lots of governments save lots of money, and the poor buggers that get thrown in jail for 5 years before they're allowed out on appeal just have to wear it, just have to cop it sweet, as they say. That is definitely a failing in our system. The final point that Ms. Ma made related to the jury system, where in China, apparently, the jurors are judges not only of the facts as they are here, but they're judges of the law as well. Well, I'm not sure that's a good idea, because in my experience, half the lawyers in Hong Kong themselves don't know what the law is, so God knows what the jury's liable to make of the law. So I'm not sure that that's a good idea. But basically, what concerns me about the laws in the glorious motherland is, what are the sources of those laws? Where do they come from? And how do they come into existence? Here, we either enact a law because the local circumstances require a particular law to meet a particular local situation, or we borrow freely from other common law jurisdictions. Our laws are passed through the parliamentary process, the Legislative Council. We elect the people who pass the laws. So, at least in theory, and in reality as well, we, the people, have some control over the laws that are passed here. I wonder if the same occurs in the glorious motherland. I have this lasting vision of a great big auditorium full of people dressed identically, all sitting there clapping in unison. And I think to myself, I wonder a bit about the quality of the laws they pass up there. The other thing about laws is this. It's all very well passing a law, but it's not the passing of laws that's the important thing. It's the enforcement of them. And if you don't have either the ability, the capacity, in logistical terms or manpower terms, to enforce a law, then the law is not worth the paper it's written on. Secondly, if you don't have the will to enforce the law, it's not worth the paper it's written on. I'm sure China has very strict currency regulations, how much you can take out of China by way of foreign currency in any one year, or even directly or indirectly. Yet we know that the biggest banking system in China is probably the underground banking system, which is basically a violation of their banking regulations. The limit people can take out of China legitimately is $50,000 US per person per year. I'm afraid that's acknowledged by the law just being ignored. Same applies to corruption. They have, I'm told, wonderful corruption laws or anti-corruption laws in China. Well, if that's the case, why is the present president engaged on a life and death struggle with a number of persons in China to stamp out corruption? Remember his comment about either tigers or flies will not be spared. So it seems that there are two areas of the law where the laws might exist, but they're just not being enforced. The other one relates to food, hygiene, baby food, melamine. We've all heard the stories and read the reports. So again, as I say, having a law doesn't mean anything unless there's a will to enforce the law. And that's where I think we differ here. Now, there are some irritating aspects of our law here being broken frequently. Illegal parking outside the front of the FCC. Try and get a taxi. There'll be four tycoons vehicles parked there, if not more. The same up the top of Glen Ely. You go down to Jackson Road, opposite the Swire Building, or opposite the Mandarin, same thing there. It's irritating. The police turned a blind eye. Why? Well, the cars belong to tycoons. We can't touch them. Taxis in wet weather and peak hours. We all see the white sign on that says I'm for hire, and the out of service sign over the arm. And if you wave a couple of red ones, suddenly the taxi's available. So that's irritating. And littering is another aspect of our laws, which we don't enforce very well. You get down to Aberdeen Harbour and it looks like a sewer, and it's a shame. But comparing the two, the ones that we don't enforce here are irritations. The ones they don't enforce in the glorious motherland seem to be more substantive. Lawyers. In the glorious motherland, we regularly read in the newspapers that lawyers are arrested and jailed for attempting to represent either unpopular clients or unpopular causes. By and large, that doesn't happen to our lawyers in Hong Kong. In fact, the only lawyer that I can think of in Hong Kong that regularly gets arrested and charged is me. But that was a long time ago. The ICAC and I have kissed and made up. It's at least 10 years since they last did that, and I think we're both too old, so we've given up. Judges. And I don't know what the source of their judges are, but I suspect it's not the same as ours. Ours come through the system. Our judges are drawn from the legal profession, so by and large, you get men of experience, hopefully on both sides, whether civil or criminal, who, because of their years of experience, are invited to sit as judges. They don't have to sit an exam like you do in China, and that serves us fairly well. So the quality of our judiciary is good. I don't know what the quality of their judiciary is, but given the past history of military officers as sitting as judges and administrative officials, I just have a question mark. Ms. Mark can possibly answer that better than me. Finally, the other thing and the last thing that concerns me about the system up there, and I don't want to dampen Ms. Maher's enthusiasm for the system in the glorious motherland, but the last topic that I think is important is open justice. Open justice. In our system, except for some well-known and easily understandable exceptions, such as juveniles, family court matters, and pretrial reviews, for obvious reasons that I don't need to go into, those matters are not made public. But everything else is public justice. And you know at present, I'm not going to comment on the facts of the case, but there's a huge case going on where the second most senior official in the last chief executive's administration is on trial, charged with massive corruption. Senior members of the community in the building industry and the real estate industry are also on trial. Would that have happened in China? Would the second most senior official be on public trial so that everyone can read about what he's alleged to have done wrong? And I'm not making any judgment as to whether he did or he didn't. But would that be allowed in China? I mean, we've had a series of cases. I can just remember a couple of them, but just recently, a member of this club, Peter Humphreys, and his wife in Shanghai were convicted in respect of the GSK, the was GlaxoSmithKline trial with providing unauthorized information. He got 3.5 years, she got 3 years. Closed court. Remember the trial not long ago of the official Bo Jilai, and before that his wife, Gu Kaolai. She's alleged to have killed, if not murdered, a British businessman. Again, closed court. All of these are heard in camera. And some time ago, a couple of years ago, there was an Australian-Chinese official, I think worked for one of the big mining companies, might have been Rio Tinto, and he got about 7 years. And again, it was a closed court. We don't operate on a system of closed courts. And when a country operates on a system of closed courts, you have to ask yourself, why? Open justice is the hallmark of a fair legal system that has nothing to fear from criticism or scrutiny. We have such a system. They don't. And I question why. Run out of time, but we'll be happy to take any questions that anyone's got about anything within reason.
Kevin and Jay, thank you very much for your thought-provoking and incisive discussion today. We're just about to go on to 2 o'clock. We have one person raising their hand here, but then I'm going to say at 2 o'clock, we will end the lunch, but I think both Jay and Kevin are here for further discussion and questions. And of course, Jay Ma's book is on sale. So one question from the front.
Yeah, Mr. Egan and Mr. Jay Ma, Ms. Jay Ma, I'm Andrew Lam. Now, on Saturday, I asked Kevin whether this occasion is meant to be a debate or a presentation. He told me, I don't know. I haven't prepared my speech yet. That was Saturday. So as usual, Egan's remark, the ribbon is not cut. In those days, solicitor would deliver a packet of document, wrapped it with a ribbon. Ribbon is not cut until the last moment. Now, I want to defend our system. To Jay Ma, I just want to ask you something by sharing with my experience, personal experience. Last March, that was last year's March last year, a very good friend of mine, traveling to Highland, managed to have a tee off in the following morning on a newly opened golf course. He arrived, it was about 8 o'clock in the evening, having a dinner, and then after that, they have a drink in the lobby. All of a sudden, a few men came forward and have him subdued. And since then, no news heard of his fate. Now, of course, the only thing we knew of, the family knew of, was those men who subdued him and took him into custody were actually a police officer. That's it. No inquiry. All the inquiry made, no reply. But this is for JMA. You learned the system. 4 months, you took the exam. So what can one do in that system? Having a family member got arrested, taken away, no news. That was March last year.
But surely it's not me who authorized their arrest. But what they should do, honestly, they should get a lawyer in the area, because the lawyers know the rules and they know the contacts, inverted commas, okay? The contacts, they have those. And that's a sensible way to do. You should contact a lawyer who has contacts.
Contacted, not the lawyer. As you know, during the investigative stage, God knows how long, lawyers is not accessible. There's no lawyer under their law. No lawyer is allowed to see any suspect. So lawyer is out of question. So that is the experience I have. So you can think about, on paper, of course, they can beautifully draft something that is better than our system. If JMA is for them, I have a number of questions for you, but this is not an occasion.
I see there is plenty of room for discussion ahead. Again, Kevin and JMA, I'd like to thank you for coming and present you with a small gift from the club, and thank everyone in the audience for coming to join today, and I hope the discussion continues over the legal system in Hong Kong. Thank you very much.